Transmission start. Welcome to Where Did the Road Go? Join us as we wander off the path and explore lost history, consciousness, the paranormal, unexplained mysteries, alternative thought, and much more. We are present on the web at wheredidtheroadgo.com. Now here is your host, Soraya.
Greetings and welcome to tonight's edition of Where Did the Road Go? I am talking tonight with Susan B. Martinez. She's a PhD and she's written a book called The Lost Continent of Pan, The Oceanic Civilization at the Origin of World Culture. This is kind of a weird story, though. Her research is based on what's called the OASPE Bible. And it's a piece of automatic writing. And she basically went through and tried to see if any of the work in there held up to our scientific standards. And ironically, right after doing this interview, this news article popped up on allthatisinteresting.com that says some Pacific Islanders have DNA not linked to any known human ancestor. And that is kind of what she's talking about in this book. So it was interesting that it popped up right then. The last line of the article says, "We're missing a population, or we're misunderstanding something about the relationships. Human history is a lot more complicated than we thought it was." All right, without any further ado, here we go. All right, and I am talking with Susan B. Martinez. And you have written a book, your most recent book, The Lost Continent of Pan, The Oceanic Civilization at the Origin of the World Culture. Now, how many books do you have before this one?
The Pan book completes a series of three about the ancient mysteries. And before that, I had a couple of books. A few of them were biographies. And now, I had to get all this ancient history off my chest, and I got it, and it's that series ending with Pan, and now I'm going into present and future studies.
Well, that's interesting. Now you are a PhD.
Yes.
And what's your PhD in?
I went to Columbia University 100 years ago and got my degree in the Department of Anthropology, and I specialized in linguistics, ethnolinguistics. That's why there's so much. I've been a word fiend all my life, and that's why there's so much, so many word lists in the book, mm-hmm. and word connections. Archaeolinguistics.
Right.
It's a kind of an untapped field.
Yeah, I mean, I have seen other people do similar stuff, but not to the extent you did in this book, I don't believe.
Right, because they don't have the linguistic background and the obsession with words that I have.
Yeah, Laird Scranton has made some of these connections, but not on the scale you did.
Right.
Right. Okay, so this book, it sounded interesting to me right off the bat, because I've always been interested in a potential lost continent in the Pacific. I always loved David Hatcher Childress's work on that stuff. That was my favorite book of his Lost Cities series.
Right.
And what threw me a little bit is that you start kind of with the, and I'm going to see if I remember how to say this, OASPE Bible.
Right.
And I've heard of this. I mean, it was kind of on my periphery, but I had never really looked into it until I started reading your book, and then I did a little research on it. Can you explain to people what this is and why you kind of, I'm assuming you kind of took this as a starting point for where your research branched off.
Yeah, that's true. But let me sidetrack this for a second.
Okay.
You mentioned Dave a minute ago. I studied his material, of course. So he's got a certain amount of insight on the lost continent in the Pacific due to his connection with something called the Steely Group.
Right.
You've heard of it?
Yes.
Out in Illinois some decades ago. And then when I looked carefully at the Steely material, I recognized where they got their information from without attribution, the OASPE Bible.
Oh,
Okay.
Yes. Yeah. So let's see. Not too many people will date the submersion of the continent of Pan to 24,000 years ago, but that's how it's given in OASPE. I should try to answer your question, although, you know, it's kind of like asking why is the sky blue, because I've been getting my inspiration from OASPE for, 35 years or something like that.
Right.
And so my books are structured around those revelations. I'm one of the few who has a scholarly background, so I could hit the ground running with all the information in OASPE. I mean, there are followers. We're called faithists, faith in the Creator.
Mm-hmm.
And we're all over the world, but just like totally scattered and totally disorganized and, just the same as almost anything else. Where was I?
What is the origin of the Bible there?
In clinical terms, it came into the world in 1882 by process of automatic typewriting. The typewriter had just been invented in the 1870s, and so the whole thing was timed properly. The amanuensis was a doctor dentist in New York named Dr. John Fellow Nubro. And through the participation of angelic legions, these books came through. There's a total of 36 books.
Wow.
Within OASPE, it's like 750,000 words. It was delivered through the instrumentality of Dr. Nubro's hands, but it was an angelic transmission scheduled for this new era that we entered a century and a half ago. And with revelations for the future, the OASPE Bible, when I'm asked to describe it, I say has three areas of knowledge. One is the ancient past. The other is science and cosmogony. And the third is spirit world, revelations on all accounts. And so the chronologies that are in OASPE, really what I've been using my books and my time for, is to check them through our current knowledge and see how much they're corroborated or not. But since I totally believe in the revelations given in OASPE, I'm going after sources of confirmation.
Right, right. Have you ever found anything that outright contradicts it?
Every day, every minute of every hour.
When you talk about Atlantis in the book, you kind of dismiss a lot of the psychic information that's been gotten about Atlantis. Why is the OASPE Bible different?
You want to talk about the OASPE Bible, or do you want to talk about my opinion on that subject?
Both, actually.
Because I could answer you either way, but I'm inclined to give my opinion first.
Okay, go ahead.
Hey, this is not standard New Age stuff you're getting from me or my books. Don't expect it to... concerned with that.
No, and having read the entire book, I can say you are very grounded in everything you're studying here. You present a great wealth of evidence, both linguistically and from oral traditions around the world. And you do match it up with stuff that is written in the OASPE Bible. I'm just wondering why that stuck with you, but you're more dismissive of other channeled work. Like, because you throw Atlantis out. You have a whole chapter, you know, talking about how you don't think Atlantis was a real place.
Soraya.
Yes.
Other channels are as good as the truth within them. And when you have the literature before you, you have stuff that's half true and half not true. And I'm old enough. I really am old enough to throw out the stuff with half truths and to be spending my time looking for the truth.
Okay.
So when it rings, I believe that the Creator gave us the potential for wisdom. And when we do not develop it or when we ignore it, we get tangled up in all kinds of lies. Okay, so this is my personal mission. I don't want to say mission, but you know what I'm saying.
To
get at the truth. To me, Atlantis is a big hype. To me, reincarnation is a big hype. To me, the ancient astronauts is a big hype. And it don't matter how much print it goes into it, because, you know, once it's in print, the next guy quotes it, then the next guy quotes two more guys, and you can build a lie into a phony truth any day. Any day. And that is the history of epistemology, man's knowledge, and where we stand right now. Because where we stand right now is in a welter of confusion.
Well, that is very, very true. Let's go into some of the stuff you have in here. You're talking about, obviously, the language connections around the world, but particularly around the Pacific Rim, as well as the culture and stuff. And obviously our current science says that there was a Siberian land bridge and people went across the bridge, and that's why there
are
similarities.
Another hype.
Yes.
Another hype. The Bering Strait. It's
yes.
Another hype. So, you know, I can't answer to all that big lies they've been teaching for 100 years. I can't answer it. I can answer to what I know and what I've studied and what really is my purpose of my life.
Okay. Well,
that I can answer to.
What? So when we talk about a continent in the Pacific, you know, that you call Pan, other people have called it Mu or Lumeria. How big do you think this continent was?
Oh, it was huge. I mean, as huge as and aberrant the size of the Pacific Ocean is today. That's how huge the continent was. It was triangular shape, and it part the westernmost part was Japan. In the very northeast corner, it touched the northwest coast of America.
Okay,
you know, just. It's maybe island change, but there were connections.
Okay. And that's a large amount of land to have disappeared, but you're saying it went down 24,000 years ago.
Right. Does it matter? It doesn't. I mean, it matters for the record, but does it matter if it went, you know, I mean, what's the...
Well, I think,
why is that
I think being so long ago might be why, if something like that went down, we wouldn't see as much evidence for it.
Well, anything, you see, evidence, you know, I'm doing a lot of research right now, Soraya, and I'm really all tangled up with this bureaucratic way that knowledge is being put forth by the experts, so don't mind me if I go crazy when you say a buzz, you know, one of the buzzwords, you say
okay.
One of them buzzwords, and I go buzzo. The word was evidence. Hey. You know, I know why I'm like this. I'm really into some studies of Tesla.
Uh-huh.
Nikola Tesla right now, and I'm drawing up a timeline. And I've got a very hot source. You know, when you see what they've done to Tesla,
yeah,
you know, 100 years ago, and we still haven't fixed it. Okay, right there is where, let's not make our reference point what the big lies have been telling us.
Well, you just got to follow the money with things like Tesla. I mean, he's offering free energy. That's not something that people are going to promote. At least the big
people. Exactly.
I mean, you get that even now. You know, that's why we're still on fossil fuels.
Hey, and so that's what the now story is going to be about, and the future story is going to be about, where the ether science that the Tesla rediscovered. I mean, Aristotle knew about it. Paracelsus knew about it. A lot of people knew about it, but then come the the Morris, what do they call it? The Morley Morrison experiment of the 1880s, you know, which built up to the quantum and relativity. And they're totally contradictory in saying that there's no ether. All they have done is given it new names: dark matter, dark ether, mysterious mesons. I don't care what they call it, but it's all come down to ether. And, you know, that went out when Tesla went out. And by the way, I don't think he had a natural death.
Yeah, that's entirely possible. Okay, so let's get back to the book a little. One of the things I found really interesting is that you talk about these little people who were the first people.
Right. And that was the first book in the series to illuminate the ancient past. And it totally rewrites everything we know, Soraya. So, you know, let's not get too burdened down in that. This is a new revealed history. It's going to be the standard history 100 years from now. The first book in the series was called The Lost History of the Little People. The second book in the series was an anti-Darwin book. You know, that's another one down the toilet. Evolution and Natural Selection. And the third book was Pan, where the, you know, where the people, where our ancestors came from. So that completes the story, but it does start with little people, because that's who Homo sapiens was.
Okay, and now you find mention of this in a lot of ancient cultures, and I don't think people realize that.
That's right. You want to talk about evidence? Well, okay, look at all the mysteries and unanswered questions and see under which heading they will align. And they align under the histories revealed in the OSB Bible.
Okay. The now, can you tell us a little bit about these early little people?
3 feet tall, beautiful, well shaped, half angel, half man. That story is told in detail in the first book. They intermixed with all the indigenous tribes in every place, and so new races were formed, and then those races intermixed, and new races were formed, and that spells out the whole, all the records of the race. There's no evolution there whatsoever.
Okay. And what was the name of them?
They were called Ihin. I-H-I-N.
Okay. Now, do you think that this is related to, like, the what science calls the hobbits they have found now out in the Pacific Southwest?
Oh, of course. Any little people that are found are part of that gene pool.
And how many cultures do you think you found that reference little people?
Everyone. Almost everyone. I mean, there's no limit or no a continent that has a monopoly on little people or the intermingling of the races.
Okay. One of the things you talk about is the similarity of head flattening and why that might have been done. Why would they flatten their heads?
Oh, that's great. Dave Hatcher Childress wrote about that, and I wrote about it. And okay, this comes from OASPE, and there's some very nice descriptions where you can appreciate it and make an immediate link to the Flathead Indians and all of the other people who practice cranial deformation, all parts of the world, the Pacific, France, I don't know, everywhere. Goes back to a time in Egypt where the Egin, the special class of persons who underwent head flattening, were used for purposes of prophecy. And those histories and descriptions are very interesting, in all OASPE. Then you can put that together with the literature on head flattening, because it's extensive. But no one seems to know, and there's a lot of guesswork, what motivated it. But the original purpose was to drive up the light into the higher portions of the brain and create a prophet, a seer. They were kind of like idiot savants.
Okay.
It was, not such a wholesome practice. Hmm. But I think in later times people forgot the original thing that caused it, and ignorantly continued the practice.
Right, right. Well, we see that a lot.
That's for sure. And not just head flattening. Only flatheads.
You also talk about giants. And now, were the giants here the whole time?
Yeah, because some of that interbreeding, the way those genes combined, were incredible offspring, some of them very tall. And then there was actually a period of giantism in the world. And I think, I don't know, but I have a feeling it was around 40,000 years ago, of the plants, the animals, the people. There were giants all over the world. And those histories are getting known now. There are quite a few books on giants.
Yeah. Yeah. Now, from the research you did with the giants, a lot of times I hear that the giants were not particularly friendly.
That's a nice way to put it. Would you like to rephrase that?
That they were rather hostile to man.
There you go. Now you're talking. They were the barbarians and some of the more mindless tribes, for sure.
One of the things you talk about is how the little people didn't build these great monoliths and monuments to themselves and such, and that's part of the reason that we don't see anything kind of left of them, other than the stories.
That's right. I think they were expensive cremators also, which is another reason we don't have that much fossil evidence, but we have enough. But okay, their progeny from one of these interracial unions, mm-hmm, were giants. Well, compared to them, they were giants, but they were large people. Particularly the race called Gans. It's spelled G-H-A-N. You've probably seen it because you read the book.
Right.
Afghanistan has that name in it. It directly means the land of the Gans. Large people, and they were the monument builders and the kings and the warriors and whatnot. the little people, they had little people blood, but they also had the barbarian. They were a perfect mix. So that's the history of the Gonds. It's not the history of the little people, none of the monuments. The little people were the priestly caste in the world. They had, and they were pure in spirit, and they were communed constantly with the angelic world. They had nothing to do with the grandiosity of the pyramids and the rest of it.
Okay. You talk a bit about sun worship as well, and how this was more about nobility and slavery than anything else.
Yeah, I thought that had to be said. I mean, the literature as it stands now, you know, the alternative literature is full of adulation of monuments and pyramids. And I mean, those were pretty monstrous regimes when you come right down to it.
And this, and how does this tie in with sun worship?
The sun worshippers were those people. They sacrificed human beings. They had a strong caste society. Are those things we admire?
Well, unfortunately, it is. It may not seem like it, but it is. I mean, when I was reading this and thinking about that, I mean, I think you made the point that we make monuments to war heroes who are out there killing other people.
That's all I wanted to do, was make that point, Soraya.
I mean, I realize that violence sometimes is unavoidable, but we're still a very violent tribal planet, unfortunately, and we shouldn't be, but we are.
Well, we're heading out of that now. How much worse could things get before we blow ourselves up or whatever?
Yeah.
We're coming out of it. That's why I'm going into the future studies now. I to complete this work, the revelations from Awaspe. Really, I mean, I've got my hands full. There aren't other people. Only I can name a handful of people in the world today who could take this information and translate it into what is, what was, and what is to come. And we're coming out of it now. We're in the darkest hour before the dawn.
Hmm. When I was doing a little research on the Awaspe Bible, one of the criticisms of it, one of the few criticisms of it actually I could find, was that some of the prophecies had not come to pass.
Know where you got that?
No. They didn't go into detail. That was all they said.
Listen, do me a favor, okay? Jot this down. Studyofawaspe.com.
Okay.
Okay, that's not my website, but that's the one I use on the radio to refer to, because I don't have I don't really have a website. But this is my colleague, James Michael McGill, out of California, and he has the best Awaspe website in the world. He has, the last time I talked to him, he had a list of Awaspe prophecies that have come to pass, and he was up to 67 of them. And so, name me one prophecy from Awaspe that did not come to pass, please.
Okay, all right. Now I have something I can look more into as well. Like I said, they didn't actually cite any examples before. For the most part, I didn't see a lot of hefty criticism like I do on most channeled material.
That in itself is very nice to hear.
It's kind of like Jane Roberts in the same way. I mean, the Seth material, when I first started looking into it, I didn't see a lot of negative debunking on it. I was actively searching it out and couldn't find it.
Okay.
So... if we look at, you talk about the Ice Age and how you don't think there was an Ice Age.
Right. I covered that in chapter 2 of my next to last book, which was called Delusions in Science and Spirituality. And so I devoted a chapter to it because it needed it. And, you know, I think I had, I actually had James Churchward on my side in, on that account. Am I right?
I'm not sure.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure. In any case, there was a lot of his evidence. Yeah. A lot of his evidence of, you know, how to account for these striated glaciers and glacial striation and so forth. You probably would ask me, so how do I explain the ice? I explain it by the oscillation of the Earth. And this is where the science part and the cosmogony comes in. The Earth itself, you've heard of pole shift, of course, but
yes.
I'm not talking about a sudden one, which is, again, the big hype. I'm talking about the Earth oscillating, changing north and south, changing position every 200,000 years or whatever. It's I never arrived at a correct figure. But because of that oscillation, every part of the Earth moves through the polar regions and experiences ice, you know, including India and Europe and South America, everything. You see, it's impossible for the Earth to heat up and cool down. I mean, if you know the first things about cosmogony, that's just child's play.
Okay, all right. Now, you also talk about 3,000-year cycles. Now, what are those about?
Oh, those are so good. Those are cycles of civilization.
Okay. And so where are we in one of those cycles now?
We're just ending a 3,000-year cycle, and in 1848 began a new 3,000-year cycle, and this time it's special. It's called Cosmon, and it's the midpoint, approximately the midpoint of man's tenure on Earth. And so it's part two, and we're going into part two right now, Soraya, and that's why you've got to be strong, you've got to hold your faith, and follow your instinct. And keep the faith, because things are turning over big time. 35 years from now will be almost unrecognizable. 235 years from now will be the complete utopia kicking in.
So basically you're saying things are going to get better.
Of course. Of course. You think Creator would let us suffer like this for nothing?
Let's see. Why is it that you dismiss Atlantis?
Oh, that thing has been hyped from day one. I mean, there's nothing. Read one book after another about Atlantis, and at the end, it's inconclusive. There's nothing. There's mistaken identity. The diaspora from Pan, to get back to our supposed topic. The diaspora from Pan ended up in settling five different disparate parts of the world, the major parts of the world. And so these cousins continued their practices. And so when we find similarities between Egypt and Mexico, say, it's not because Atlantis was in between. It's because brothers dispersed and settled in different parts of the world. Here's another thing that just occurred to me recently. Atlantis is a very Anglo origin for things.
Mm-hmm.
The Pacific is not does not have the Englishman's bias for locating the center of a mysterious and high civilization.
Okay.
So that's another grounds, because the Celtophiles in Europe made a thing of it, and so did the Americans. But even geologically, you know, read through the Atlantis chapter and you'll see what I'm talking about.
No, you definitely make a good case for it. And I think a lot of ancient alternative history people are kind of moving away from that. Even Graham Hancock has said there was probably never an Atlantis, but maybe more of a worldwide civilization.
There you go.
One of the things that people like Graham are looking at are the Southeast Asian area that would have been above water during the last ice age, or whatever, however you want to refer to it, you know, 12,000 years ago. Could that have had anything to do with Pan? Was that part of Pan at one point?
I'll tell you, to me, I'm just chuckling, because to me, it's like they're inching their way to Pan. They're inching their way over, because that's more like a Lemuria thing. And certainly, I know that they have found artifacts in the Indian Ocean and whatnot, so that there was something going on there as well. But it's not the same story as Pan. It's just a separate place, and it's certainly not Atlantis, unless you want to make it Atlantis. People have made everything Atlantis. So.
Yes.
So what's stopping us?
Although, honestly, my favorite version of a possibility of Atlantis has to be Antarctica.
Well, that's where they always end up with Antarctica, you know, because who can prove it, who can disprove it. I'm not going there. I'm not going to the Antarctic. It's too cold.
One of the things you found is a lot of the, like, especially the Christian stories seem to have much older precursors. Noah being one of the big ones you talk about in this book, but you also talk about pre-Christian crucifixation stories of the gods being crucified and such.
Come at that from a different angle, because I'm not sure what you're talking about.
You have stories of other gods prior to the Christian era being crucified for the redemption of mankind in here.
Yes. Okay. So, what is the question?
Can you talk about some of those?
Well, I got a lot of my research data from Paul Perov in Australia, who is a faithist and a Waspian, and he's also got a website, but I don't recall it. He's the one who did all that research on these pre-Christian crucifixions. And so what do you want to tie it into, actually, Soraya? Because my mind is going in different directions.
Well, I guess what you seem to represent in the book is that there's a lot of a lot of stories that ended up, say, in the Old Testament that have a lot of precursors in the stuff in the Pacific Rim that you're digging up, a lot of these stories.
I don't know. I can't connect to that with any intelligent answer. I'm not seeing Christian and Pacific Rim in the same
Well,
paragraph.
Like Noah, for instance. For instance, Noah was
okay,
the story in
go.
The Old Testament.
There you go.
Okay.
Okay, you done it. You done did it. We all know about Noah, right?
Yes, of course. I hope everyone knows about Noah.
Okay.
Fairly
well,
famous story.
Not everybody, the way they're teaching kids in school. But, okay, maybe they... So most of us know about Noah, and what I'm trying to say is that this is this book that I wrote, The Lost Continents of Pan, is about Noah. It's about Noah and the flood. And the flood was not something that happened in Mesopotamia, the original flood. The flood was actually the submersion of the continent of Pan 24,000 years ago. Noah, the Bible remembers three of his sons. The Christian Bible remembers three of his sons, Shem, Ham, and Japheth. OSPE remembers five of his sons, Shem, Ham, and Japheth. Japan and Gautama. Oh, Yista. Okay. Yista and Gautama. Gautama was the son who landed in America, and Yista was the son who survived in Japan. So those are the five different places I referred to a short time ago.
Mm-hmm.
So we do have a, there we have an agreement. I have found many stories to agree with the Holy Bible.
Okay, all right. So who was Noah?
Noah was, is the name, it's really tribal. It's not a man, first of all. Noah represents a lineage. You can even guess that from, you know, the way Bible history is run. Noah represents a lineage. He represents the Ihans, the little people who were stranded on the continent of Japan. They were being persecuted. They were hiding out in the mountains. They received through their shamans and priests the foreknowledge that the continent would be sunk, and they were instructed to build boats. And, you know, that's where your parallels with the Noah story pick up. And they went out in five fleets, Shem, Ham, Japheth, Yista, and Gautama, and landed in the five different parts of the world.
Hmm. Now, does this connect into stories of say, Quetzalcoatl and stuff?
No, but Quetzalcoatl comes into chapter 6, where I create an interlude for the book to get off some more steam. It wasn't exactly related to the content of the book, but it was necessary. I don't know, so I called it an interlude. And we're dealing a lot with false prophets in the span of that interlude, chapter 6. Quetzalcoatl was one of them. You see, there's another hype for you. You know, all the stuff they believed, we believe. We've took the myths and made it our own myths. But those were tribal myths, mostly used to control people.
Hmm. Okay. That was part of their downfall, too, when the Europeans showed up.
You got it.
Let's talk a little bit about Yanaguni. Now, you said there are some Yanaguni tablets?
Whether they're tablets or inscriptions, I can't exactly tell you, but a Yanaguni expert could. But there are inscriptions with figures and glyphs and letters that correspond to the Panic alphabet. That's from that's the adjective Panic for the continent of Pan. It also, look how it survived 24,000 years into a vocabulary, Panic, pandemonium, when an entire continent goes down.
Yeah. And you have, as we said at the beginning, you have extensive word lists in here connecting various cultures and words like pan and such, and how they're still used throughout our dialect.
That's absolutely right. So things, language is another, you know, it's a strength of the way things survive. And the gene pool, too. We have many sources of information if we learn to use them properly. We have to get the myths out of the way, Soraya. We're not going to make any progress until we just face up to what's bull and what you can really put your money on.
You talk about some of the Pacific Islands and the megaliths that are found there. And one of the things you said that I guess I didn't realize is that some of these megaliths are built with blocks that are not found on those islands.
Well,
like they're
sure.
The actual rock.
Yeah, I think Childress did a good job of documenting that sort of thing because he had so much documentation on the Pacific and the geology. Not just missing quarries, but underwater paveways connecting islands.
Okay, but wouldn't the Ice Age also have raised the water levels and thus, you know, put that stuff underwater without the sinking of an entire continent?
What Ice Age?
But we know there was ice at one point. That would have taken up at least some of the water on the planet.
Yeah, well, the time frame is 24,000 years for submersion. The time frame for the oscillation of the Earth is in the hundreds of thousands of years. So I don't even know if I don't even think the Pacific has had ice on it. But what if it did? What's your point?
Well, what I'm saying is, is this proof of Pan, or is this something that happened later on?
What does this refer to?
The underwater paths between islands and some of these monument structures and stuff.
And you're saying that can be explained by what?
Well, what I'm saying is, if the water level was lower, say 12,000 years ago,
yes,
this stuff may not have been submerged, like Yanaguni. They said Yanaguni would have been above water 12,000 years ago.
Oh, okay. All right.
So if that were the case, is it proof of Pan, or is it something that would have happened after Pan?
I don't know.
Okay. All right. You said there are also some ruins in the Pacific and off the coast of Easter Island.
Right.
Now, what's off the coast of Easter Island? I know Robert Schock said he thought he found quarries, or what looked like quarries underwater out there.
Okay, there you go. There's a lot of documentation of it. I don't have it on the tip of my tongue. I do recall that when they, some representative from the UN, this is a few decades back, and I think in 1970, around there, was in Hawaii and found out about some underwater structures that led out to the sea. And the military came along and put a cork on the whole thing. So, you know, there's information, there's missing information, there's suppressed information. But once you research the question of the underwater structures in the Pacific, it looks pretty good for them having been on the surface approximately 20 or 24,000 years ago.
Okay. You talk a little bit about the Basque people, and the Basque people are unique in their blood type. How does that connect into this puzzle?
Oh, it is really, there's an enigma for you, because they've also got the only language in Europe that is not Indo-European. So their language and their blood. Hey, weren't we talking about genes and language a few minutes ago? Is a good sign, the best sign. So they indicate elsewhere. So where did they come from? The best kind of trace, I could trace them up towards, ultimately toward around Asia Minor. In an earlier phase, you know, I'm saying 15, I think, you know, okay, just off the wall 15,000 years ago, in the first phase into Europe, not the later phase, which was only about 8,000 years ago into Europe, but the first phase, I think they were there before. They've got real connections to the Scotch, so that brings the connection up to the north. And then those channels, I think, will all connect back to the east, just as the European people do, and as well as from Egypt.
Okay. You talk a bit about mound building, too. I mean, we know there was an unknown mound building culture here in the United States. You talk about it in other areas as well, but the mound builders were the giants or the small people?
The little people, because they built it themselves. They built very large mounds. I think that their mounds were minimum 18 feet high. If you find anything much smaller, it's a different, the later peoples who were imitating the sacred tribes by building sacred mounds. But originally, it was exclusively the home of the little people. They kept apart and they lived apart. That was their instructions from the hierarchy of light. Keep separate. Of course, they broke the rules and, you know, they intermarried, but
which is also a story you hear in like every culture.
Yes. These are only flat top mounds we're talking about, because any pointing mounds, that those were built by later people, you know, the grandiose ones. But no, only flat top, because they lived on them and they dug into it and they lived inside as well. This was the Mesolithic period when of giantism still, and so there were predatory beasts roaming the landscape that would look awful to even us, but to the little people who were defenseless and pacifists and non-warriors, they were much to be avoided. So they lived on the mounds to for self-protection, but also to remain apart from the people of the world.
Okay. I think we've covered most of the stuff I wanted to talk about in this book. This book is long. It's almost 500 pages long. It is filled with correspondences between these different cultures and support for the idea that there was a lost continent in the Pacific. It's despite being 500 pages long, it's a very easy read. It wasn't something you have to trudge through. What do you have next on your plate?
Well, like I said before, like today, I was researching Tesla and all that. Now I can get back to it, but I was also researching Mars. I'm still hitting on the hypes, Soraya. I mean, I can't get away from it. I cannot get away from it. The Mars hype, it's just bugging the heck out of me. And now I'm seeing, you know, news stories on it all over time now. So I spent a lot of time today going back on my research on Mars and building my case for the folly of such programs romancing us into going to other planets and conquering them. Okay, so all of that, including the Tesla and plenty of other stuff, is for the future. Like I said before, I got off my chest all the ancient history material. Really, you can, those three books really represent what I think is the meat of the knowledge given in OWASP, so that's took care of. But now I see what the world needs, and I'm back in present time, and I'm moving toward the future. So I'm trying to get some more prophecy together to write a book about what's coming.
Okay. All right. And you don't have a webpage, right?
No, but I want anyone interested in this to go to studyofoaspe.com for my buddy Mike's website, which is really overwhelming.
All right. And then the book, The Lost Continent of Pan, is out on Bear & Company.
Yes. And do you want to hear about more of my project?
Sure, sure.
Or are you out of time?
No, we can go a couple more minutes. What else?
Okay, let me tell you, Soraya, because, you know, I'm sort of at a turning point. You know, I'm getting away from the type of writing I've been doing. You know, that's what every writer should be free to do. You know, branch out, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Right, but it's tough. It's going back to square one as a writer, because on the one hand, I wrote a novel.
Oh.
Yeah, last year, and I'm having a real hard time getting it published because I'm nobody in the publishing world except for, you know, that small world that follows the type of, you know, publication that Inner Traditions produces. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
I'm having a tough time. The novel is about a archaeologist who gets murdered because of she's gone too far exposing the hype. okay, and I wrote another nonfiction book. I wrote a nonfiction book called Why? The Anatomy of School Shooting.
Oh.
Yeah, so I spent another year researching school shooting and following it in the news and writing a book about it. And so, see, that's off topic also for me, right?
yeah, a little bit.
I'm supposed to keep writing books about Pan and the giants and the little people, but I'm done with that. You know, that's what I'm trying to say. I'm moving on. I want to look at social issues, stuff we have to live with now. I've been an amateur criminologist for half my life, and so I was able to put it together in this book about school shooting. The bottom line there is that we really need to understand some of the negative stuff that's coming from the spirit world. We really need to understand the overshadowing of human beings by spirit personalities, those who've gone before, our deceased relatives, angels and criminals and all whatnot that's in the world above and how it affects and inflicts us. That's a school shooting project, and I still have not sold that book. And in the meanwhile, I'm covering a lot of different topics on globalism and what the coming race is going to be like, and the 3,000-year dawn that you were asking about before, which is upon us. So it's really a chance to jump in and get a grip on what's happening to us right now and what we should be doing and what we should be believing and what we should not be believing. And again, you know, just pulling in as much common sense and evidence for these thoughts.
All right. Well, the school shooting one isn't out yet. What about the novel? Is that out?
No, both of them are trying to be sold.
Okay. Okay. So something to watch for then.
Yeah. And to help me get it published.
All right. I thank you for spending some time with us. And this is an impressive piece of work, this Lost Continent of Pan book. And thank you.
Okay, you're very welcome.
All right, and to close off the show tonight, we're going to hear something very, very heavy, but also very appropriate to what we've been talking about. My thanks to Bob Headley for setting this along. His band is Racing Fate, and this is a song called Redemption, and I will be putting the lyrics on the website so you can check them out, because you may not be able to quite understand them. This is some pretty heavy death metal here, but they apply very, very well. So here you go. And you can find them on Facebook at facebook.com/racingfate. See you next time.
Coming to